Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the midweek show. Still playing with needles.
Still. In fact, I have one in my hand right now.
All contorted on the couch, propped up.
As a matter of fact, I am, Gary. I am sitting with my legs scooched underneath me with a canvas over my knees.
Scooched?
Yes, that's a technical term. Do you not know it?
No, and I'm writing that down right now. Scooched.
Very okay. Good. That is the posture one adapts when doing embroidery without a scroll frame and one of the wonderful frames like you have.
Scooched. Okay.
Yes.
New term. Written
it's
down
an adaptation.
Right here. It's in the ledger. In the ledger. Mm-hmm. So, okay, weird experience for me. Now, you know, we've done hundreds of podcasts, and just as a rule, I don't re-listen to them. You know, we record them, clean them up, post them, done. Don't listen.
Yes.
I have had to make, our office is an hour away, and I've had to make trips the past couple days, for meetings. So I've had 4 hours, and tomorrow, Wednesday, we're recording Tuesday, so Wednesday I have to do it again. The last time this week. So anyway, a lot of car time. And as I don't know if I mentioned on this, on Fiber Talk, but Mark Maron and his WTF podcast is one of my favorites. And one of his ended while I was driving. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, my podcast app on the iPhone, flipped to one of ours. And it was the Vonna Pfeiffer one.
Okay. And, the most recent one?
Yeah, and normally okay. I would just switch it off. But I thought, you know, I'm just going to listen, you know, kind of as a quality control thing. You know what I mean?
Not like you actually like it or anything.
I just want to make sure, you know, the volumes are okay and we can understand people. So I ended up listening. I got about 20 minutes left now. And, you know, I'd missed stuff while we were recording.
Yes.
And stuff did not stick with me. So it became one of those things. First, I had to get past, you know, the usual listening to yourself talk thing. But mm-hmm. I ended up, you know, riveted to what she was saying. And so I picked up a couple things that I missed when we recorded. And so now I think I'm going to go back and listen to some of the others and see what I missed out. So it was just kind of a weird experience.
It is. And, you know, it's funny because it actually correlates with what I've been doing myself, because on Instagram, when we first got started, you know, we started kind of a little tentatively and slowly with the idea that this was going to be really fun for us, and we had no idea if anybody else was going to actually enjoy it at all. So our Instagram account, you know, was slow to begin with. So what I've been doing is now sort of looking back to the very beginning and starting to post some references to earlier things that we've done. And in doing so I've done not just the most recent thing, but I've gone way back to the very, very beginning. And so the first one was Debbie Rowley. The second one was Vonna Pfeiffer. And in looking back at that one, it was great because I was remembering all the things that we talked about then. And quite frankly, just from a personal perspective, at that time, you know, I had been knitting and crocheting and doing all of, you know, other kinds of needlework for many years, but I hadn't done needlepoint in many, many years. And now we have, you know, what, 4 or 5 months under my belt that now I have a little bit of perspective and context to listen to that conversation. So I did exactly the same thing. And I listened to the first Vonna podcast, and it was a completely different experience because A, I had the context, but B, it's exactly as you said, you missed things. And also, it's just a nice conversation, you know, it's just exactly what we set out to do, which is just a couple of people sitting around talking about things that we love, you know, and generally I would say the people that we've met through this path that we've taken, have been delightful. So you can listen to them again and again, quite frankly, because they're fun, you know, they're enjoyable. And Vonna is a person that, you know, if people are logging onto YouTube to watch her sit there, clearly she has something to offer. So listening to her actually talk is even better.
Yep. Well, she's terrific. Yeah. And Orna Willis. Now we, I think I've mentioned a couple, three times that I'm taking a class that Orna is offering. It's called Come Design With Me. And what we're doing is a little 10 by 10 piece that Orna is designing on the fly. So we're getting to watch the design process as it goes. And Christine and I did a podcast just for the class with Orna. And I hope we can do another one with her before the class ends. And then we talked about doing one that we would share with everyone, because this has just been for the class. But I have to say, if you get a chance to take a class from Orna Willis, do it. What a treat. What an absolute treat. And, of course, talented. I mean, that's not hard to figure out. But just a treat to experience what she does with a design. And her command of color is frightening. I have no idea. I just have no idea how she...
Frightening is the right word.
How she makes all these threads work together. I never saw it, but the minute she puts them down, you know, they make sense. But, yeah, I just would say, chance to do a class with Orna Willis, you do it. You'll learn something. I guarantee you learn more than one something. It's been a lot of fun. So, okay. I bought some books. Nordic Needle. All right. Bought two books. They came today and I have, they came late in the day and I've not had a chance other than to leaf through them. So I got, Yvette Stanton's Early Style Hardanger. I think the people who know things say it Hardanger, and I always say Hardanger, you know, American Hardanger. So I've been practicing Hardanger.
Well, not only American, but like from Chicago.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, very
harsh. You have
harsh
a lot of excuses
and...
for not speaking, you know, correctly.
Yeah. Crudely, you mean.
I wouldn't go crudely. I would just say incorrectly. But, you know, whatever. I'm from New York, so what can I say?
Yeah, yeah. You do have to be careful there. Yeah. So this book, fantastic. Wow. Just leafing through, what detail on how to do all these stitches, all the different Hardanger stitches. Oh, boy. She really... You know, there's each page is, you know, twelve little panels showing each step of the stitch, really nicely done. And then then she has projects in the book, and of course just drooling over there, those is fun. But then in the back, in a plastic bag affixed to the back cover, inside back cover, is the patterns for all of the projects, and in separate paper, so you don't have to, you know, crank your book open to copy them or do anything. It's all on separate paper so that you
right.
can take them out. And I always copy my charts because if I mark on them, I want to mark on a copy rather than I hate messing up the originals. So,
yeah.
But yeah, just a very, very, very beautiful book. Really nicely done. I can tell that every stitch I'll have no trouble learning how to do because there's the detail in the instructions is so, right, you know, really, really well done. And then to have those projects, because there's a couple little projects that I'm going to use as a starting thing, and to have those on separate sheets is a real plus. So that's, you know, tip of the cap to Yvette there. That's a nice book to have. That's my first one of hers that I bought, and might be adding a couple more. So
yeah. Well, if you're gonna buy a Hardanger book, that's Yvette is the one to go with. Just from speaking with her, you know, just getting the history of it, for me, the context of it gives it so much more weight and interest,
yes.
You know? So it becomes not just the craft itself, but all of the history that you're recreating.
Yeah, that's, yeah,
that,
I think to
that's
me,
what I like yeah. enjoy the most about it.
Yeah, all her stuff. That's what I enjoyed most about the conversation with her was the mm-hmm. history and where they came from and, yeah, yeah. And then I bought the book that you bought, Jane Nicklaus,
yes.
The Complete Book of Stumpwork Embroidery. Holy smokes!
Yeah, so I kind of have a little crush on Jane Nicklaus now, and I think we need to get her somehow. The book is absolutely stunning. So first of all, it's photographed beautifully, without doubt. And we've talked before about how photographing needlework, especially if you're using any kind of metallics or reflective threads, or anything with textures is a bit of a challenge, and we keep saying we're going to actually attack this, and and do something about it and work out some methods, and we haven't done that yet. But stump work kind of lends itself to photography because it's dimensional.
Right.
So it is photographed exquisitely. And now I think maybe you can kind of feel for me here. I got the Shakespeare flowers book that she wrote, and it was immediately itching to stitch a lot of the things in there and realize that it was way over my head. And for me to say that, you know, I'm usually jump in
right
feet first into things. So I looked at that and said, yeah, I need a training wheels with this. So I got the book that you now have in your hands. And it is still going to be difficult. It's not an easy style to stitch. Even just from the instructions of it, because you're stitching in midair, basically,
yep.
For a lot of the parts, and you're stitching on satin. There's no grid to guide you. There's no chart. You're freeforming, which I'm sure is going to be a little easier for me than you because, you know, freeform is not your thing, Gary.
Nope. It's not.
You like control and I totally understand that. And in this case, I agree with you. I would be more comfortable having something that told me exactly what to do. So here, you know, so not having done it, I'm looking at this and thinking, okay, what are the difficulties going to be? What's the challenge is going to be? And I think thread tension is going to be tremendous. Even just getting the shapes correct, because if you're building on wire, if the wire isn't drawn perfectly, then you're not going to get the shape you want. And then everything you stitch within that wire is going to be off, right? And then there's what she does. And I don't have enough knowledge of stump work to know if this is common or not, is the blending of colors is really beautiful. So, instead of using a lot of different types of threads and reflective threads and things like that, or ribbons, it's a lot of blending. So it'll be either all silks or all DMC cottons, and just colors that are very, very close, just blending from one to the other. And that's how you get your dimension partially too. So that I think is going to be a challenge as well, because it's not gridded. There's nothing that tells you this is where you make your break.
Right. Yeah. So lots of long and short stitch, which is standard embroidery. So yeah.
Right. It's painterly to me.
Yep.
In the way that the stitching, the color sort of takes shape within those pieces that are stitched down. So I think it's going to be a tremendous challenge. It's not something that I'm going to pick up easily, I don't think. That said, the pieces are so beautiful, and to me they remind me so much of my childhood, with my grandmother and my great grandmother, who were both English. This style was just part of their vernacular. So, it's something that I'm highly motivated to learn, because it makes me feel comfortable, makes me feel at home to see these things. You know, the same sort of patterns I would see in ceramic, pieces and things like that. My great grandfather was a curator of a silver museum. So a lot of the same motifs that are in these pieces, were found in pieces that we found around the house that he had, that were, you know, silver pieces that were made in England. So all of these things harken back to very early childhood memories for me. So I just really want to stitch them. So yes, it's going to be really difficult and it's daunting. But I'm ready to jump in and do it as soon as possible. And I'm kind of itching. But with that said, I will say that I bought a small embroidery hoop, and I'm going to start stitching a couple of motifs first before I do a full piece, just to kind of get a feel for, you know, almost like knitting a test patch, just to get a kind of feel for how the threads work with the backing fabrics, how they work with the wire, how you build on a wire. You know, all that I and you, if you go forward with it, we're going to have to figure out. And this is where I wish I had a class, because I would love to be able to do this with an instructor and other people, so that, you know, we could collectively, learn from others' mistakes, you know?
Yeah. Oh, I agree. Yeah.
This is one where I wish I had a class that I could sit with other people and learn.
Yeah, and get but, on the fly. Do it this way, not that way.
Yeah. So so it just means I have to make more mistakes myself, which that's fine.
Yeah, well, I'm with you because I got some of the wire too, and I'm just gonna form some things and do some of the basic stitches she shows in the beginning, and but then I think your idea, I liked your idea where we once we get at least a clue, if that's possible, then we pick one of these things and we do them together. And then we can invite other listeners. Certainly other listeners might be interested.
That'd be fun, actually. Yeah, that's a great idea.
And then talk about, what we're experiencing. So, but I already have my goal, just leafing through all of 10 minutes.
Okay.
On page 215, the pea flower roundel. Okay, that's where, that's my goal. Okay, I'll go through the steps. I'll learn the things, but that's the one that I want to, once I get enough proficiency, that's the one I'm going for, because that's, that one stuck out just leafing through all the color plates. That one stuck out for me, so.
It's beautiful. Yeah. So, being a beekeeper then, of course she has books on beetles and dragonflies, which now I'm coveting.
Yes.
And even in the flower books, insects figure pretty strongly. So if you go through those books, there's bees, there's ladybugs, there are dragonflies in a few of them. There's other elements in those books. If you look at the front piece, the actual when you open the book up in the beginning, the first piece that she talks about, that gives you the context for this entire style and how it developed and why. That piece has so many different elements, from the animals to the tiny snails that are in the piece to the little seaweeds and the fish that are in the pond.
Mm.
I mean, the detail in that is just, it's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's exciting because I know it's not going to be something that I just kind of do. Like, this is going to be one of those where I kind of have to shut the TV off and really concentrate. Yeah. Right? It's not going to be one of those relaxing pieces that we talk about.
Right.
Not for quite some time anyway.
Yeah, no, that one there, I think I would take a couple of parts out of it and just do those.
Yes. Yes, and I think that's what I'm going to do as well. They had, there's a couple of she uses the term heartsease for it. That's, I think, maybe one of the ones that I'd like to try, because it does have all of the elements of the stump work and the color blending. But it's not daunting because it's not gigantic. So that may be one that I try. And again, it's going to be a challenge because the color blending, I think, is what intimidates me the most, because it's the thing that you have the least guidance on and you have to use the most judgment. And I'm not a painter, so it's going to be, it's either going to be, terrible, with the potential of becoming something I enjoy, or it's going to be terrible with a, wow, I should really not do that again because clearly I have no aptitude for that. Or it will be, that really wasn't so bad and I can't wait to do the next one.
Mm-hmm.
And any of those possibilities is completely acceptable.
Yep. Well, I'm pretty sure that Mary Corbett has at least one video on how to do long and short stitch.
That would be nice.
Yeah. And there are a couple of others who I know have detailed instructions. So, you won't have any trouble. Mm-hmm. But, so that book there, that's going to be a sit down in the recliner and prop the feet up and spend some time with that. That stuff is impressive.
It is. And the other thing that I like about her books, and these are meaty books, is, like you said, the piece you picked is on page 251. These are not just chart books and they're not just, flimsy instruction books that just have patterns. There's history, there's context, so in the book that you're looking at, which is the beginner book, I say with air quotes.
I know, the beginner book. It looks pretty advanced.
Right. You open the book and the first thing you see is this massive piece that she stitched. And it tells you the context of why that piece exists, what elements of it were figured heavily in the history of the time. Why is there a stag there? Well, because it was important in hunting. Why is there you know, some of the other figures. What is the significance of the costumes, the clothing that the people in the piece are wearing, and why did she stitch them that way? So there's all of the sort of technical aspects of this, and you can't underemphasize, or overemphasize the amount of technicality that's involved in here. But there's also all of this rich history that goes behind it. And so then, you know, then I, because this is who I am, I read that, and it, the needlework is really just becomes a jumping off point because, okay, now I know this needlework style and I know the era from which it originates. And then I start thinking about, okay, well, what was going on in that place at that time? Why was that important? Why did people do this? And then I start reading about the history of that time. And then I start reading about the royal family at the time and the history and the, you know, the change in, you know, the political climate and, you know, because that's kind of how I go. And then it leads you into all these kind of cool places. And so in that book, you have that context of that piece that gives you all of that. In the Shakespeare book, it's all poetry. It's poetry and it's gardening, quite frankly, because in that era, that was the first time where gardening became something that was a leisure activity as opposed to farming, right? And there was a distinction between agriculture and gardening for simply, you know, beauty's sake. So she quotes a lot from Shakespeare, but she also quotes from contemporaneous garden books, which were really the first ones of their kind to be published. So you have all of that as well. So it's interesting to think about what gardens were like at the time and how people looked at them, which is very different from how we look at gardens now, and how they looked at simply the significance of different flowers, because that was a big thing at that time as well. So again, there's all of these things that you can get involved in through those books. And it has, you know, the needlework itself is such a small part of it to me. It's all of the things that the needlework brings you to that add the richness and that make me want to stitch those pieces.
Yep. Oh, this is going to be fun.
Yes, it is. So let's pick something. We'll have to pick something. And we'll start.
Yep. We'll do that. I need to spend a little time with this book though.
Yeah.
What fun. Yeah. So, yeah. So I'm armed and dangerous. Here we go. Yep. So, and then I don't know if I updated at any point. You know, I was going to take my wooden stand and modify it to hold the Millennium Scroll frame.
Yeah.
And I did. I went to the Home Depot and got some oak, had them cut the oak roughly. And then my friend Jim, Jim is a carpenter remodeler, very, very talented. And I, you know, can I impose on you to use your drill press and help me put this thing together? Sure, come over. And, you know, what are you trying to do? What are you trying to make
here?
And I had a picture. I had a picture and, you know, it's like, I'm sure in his head he's going, oh, geez, what is this? But he helped me and, got it together and brought it home and did a little testing and it worked out just great. I mean, we took the head off of the wooden stand, the clamp head, and, drilled a couple bolt holes and, made a cross piece and two arms that, come toward me and can be rotated, can be moved around with dowels on the end. And by golly, that Millennium Scroll frame sits right in there just perfect. And you can just stitch your little brains out and it's, excellent. So then I, you know, that oak, and then I just took my palm sander and just sanded the daylights out of that to make it smooth so threads wouldn't snag or anything. I didn't put any finish on. I was hesitant to do that because I wasn't really sure what to put on that I know would not transfer over time to the cloth. So I didn't want to do that. But
so, that I can actually help you with because my dad is actually, as you know, a woodworker. So having taken his advice several times, what I would recommend is if you want to change the color of the wood, you could stain it for sure. But I would recommend Danish oil.
Danish oil?
Yeah, and that's exactly what it's called. It's in a brown and white tin, essentially, and it resides in the stain aisle, at a Home Depot or someplace like that. It's called Danish oil. You can get it tinted or not tinted. But what it is it's a combination of a stain and a shellac, or an oil and a shellac. So it's sort of got properties of both, where it gives the wood the moisture that it needs from the oil, but it also gives a seal, and it's a watertight seal. So once you put Danish oil on something, you're going to get that rich finish, but it's also going to be pretty much impenetrable. So just the same way that water isn't going to get in, nothing is going to get out. So,
okay. And over time, it's not going to
transfer
off into the cloth or anything.
Nope.
Okay.
Not at all. Not at all. In fact, I used that to, finish the fish tank stand that I did. And that was it. And I've used it on quite a few things. It doesn't go anywhere. It's really pretty good.
Okay, because I do feel like this oak needs to have something on it other than just be raw wood. So,
you know, the other thing I would consider, and I don't know that I would do it, but I might do it on a test piece and then kind of see how it goes, is beeswax. Because that's what people for many years would use to finish and polish wood. You would finish it with stain and then you'd finish it with wax over it. And beeswax is something that we use in needlework quite a bit, isn't it? So, I don't know how, I don't think it would be damaging, but I would worry a little bit about overusing it, because you wouldn't want it to accumulate anywhere. But, that would be the other thing that I would think about trying. But what I would do is I'd probably try it on a test piece of wood first and just kind of have it hanging around and see sort of how the wood feels after a while to see if it, you know, if it's, I would want to make sure that it doesn't transfer to the fabric in a way that, you know, causes staining over time. That would be the only thing. Yeah. The Danish oil is not going anywhere, so you could use that.
Okay, and that I just rub on with a rag or a brush or whatever. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Then that's just what I'll do. So, yeah, I'm just really pleased with the way that came out. So now I have a stand for a scroll frame that holds the thing right where I want it, and of course, it's not attached, so I can turn it over and start and finish threads, and yeah.
That's nice.
Really great.
Are you going to take pictures, yes?
Okay. Yeah, I can. Sure.
Thank you, because then we can use them on Instagram and things like that. Well, because I think it would be nice for other people to see how you built it as well, to get an idea of how you can use the Millennium Frame.
Yes, you're right. I will do that.
It would be a generous thing to do, Gary, I'm just saying.
Okay, well, I'm all about that generous stuff, so there you have it. All right, so I have now on July 5 in Mary Corbett's newsletter, she wrote a little story that I'm just going to read it because I thought it really spoke to a lot of the things that we've covered. But before that, for some reason, with the second go round of with Mary and her sister Sarah, for some reason I decided to put an extra T on her name, Corbett instead of Corbett, and didn't notice that. Have no idea why I was compelled to do that. But then she did not post about the podcast until just a few days ago, and I don't know if she realized what she did to me, but she made a comment about, just a subtle comment about talking about correct spelling of name, of names.
And then, for you, Mary.
And then in parentheses, chortle. Well, okay.
So passive aggressive.
Yeah. So, you know, and I'm an editor, and nothing is more grating to me than misspelled words, other than poor grammar, but misspelled words just, you know, I mean, that's what I live for, is to find misspelled words.
That other people misspell.
Right. And so when I read that, I thought, what is she talking about? There's no way I misspelled a name. And so I'm eating breakfast and I'm reading this thing. I'm eating breakfast. Immediately, on my iPad, immediately I go to our site to see, and by golly, I twice had misspelled her name and put the extra T on. And I'm sure she doesn't realize, but it was just like embarrassment on top of embarrassment that I would do that. So immediately I correct it, you know, and move on. But, it was just one of those moments. And, yeah, sorry, Mary.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned it now, because then I've used your spelling from the website and have propagated that. So now I will have to go and correct it as well. So I will apologize on Gary's behalf for misleading me.
Yes. Well, completely my fault. I have no idea why I put the extra T in, because I went back. I thought, oh no, the first time we talked to her, I misspelled her name, but I didn't. So I don't know what compelled me to add a T, but anyway, they're all gone now, except for whatever you posted. And then, yeah. So anyway, in this, you know, that was one of those breakfast things, like, oh no, I'm a complete idiot. But in this July 5 newsletter that she has, and you know, you can subscribe and get notices of whatever she posts on the website, but also get her newsletter, because sometimes she has other things. So she tells this story. I'm just going to read this story, because there's no other way to do it and do it well. So it's story time, so everybody just sit back and relax. Years ago, I undertook an adult embroidery class here in my community. It wasn't really a formal class. It was a group that would meet once a week to learn. We soldiered on for quite a while, using a room at a local school to meet in and stitch together. We had fun. We covered all the basic stitches that are used on relaxing embroidery projects like flour sack towels. And many of the gals completed many flour sack towels. We made a couple embroidered baby quilts that we raffled for a fundraiser. Some gals would bring whatever they were currently working on at home to get advice or ideas. And we break for coffee and cookies. It was fun, relaxed, simple. But then it got into my head that we would kick things up a notch. We could, I enthusiastically sold the idea, embark upon embroidery with silk. And to that end, I proposed this, in parentheses, rather ridiculously complex, silk embroidery sampler. Many of the crew decided to get in on it. I ordered supplies and we set out. And you can see where this is going. Mm-hmm. I taught them how to set up a frame, how to transfer the, in parentheses again, rather ridiculously complex, design onto linen using prick and pounce. I taught them the basics of silk shading with stranded spun silk, soie d'Alger, yes. Mm-hmm. And away we plugged, though the group began to dwindle somewhat.
Shocking.
As the group dwindled, so did some of the enthusiasm. We maintained the coffee and cookies, though. We moved on to flat silk and satin stitch. We surmounted the frustration obstacles of working with flat silk by introducing laying tools. And it began to dawn on me about then, it seemed as if the sampler had become a chore rather than recreation. It was a weight, a cloud, a looming mountain. We didn't look forward to Tuesday nights with the same vim and vigor. And we began to meet less often, and when we did meet, we spent a lot of time on the coffee and cookies. And then we lost our room at the local school for our meeting spot. We tried to meet in my workroom at home for a bit, and a few came, and we had coffee and cookies and chatted, occasionally creeping through block shading with flat silk. And then life intervened for most of the gals, many of whom were moms and had kids and school and stuff to take care of. Others had full-time jobs. Others had volunteer work that occupied them. I had two jobs. The sampler waned. The interest waned. I waned. And the whole thing taught me a really good lesson. Keep it simple. Yeah. While we were doing simple things together, we had a great time. Enthusiasm was high. Everything was relaxed. Everything was as it should have been. But then I got overzealous. I wanted more, and I wasn't farsighted enough to see the consequences of leaps too large. It was a community group of beginners. Their vision was not my vision. When you want to spread the love of embroidery and get people to pick up a needle and stick with it, the trick is to know what your people want and to give it to them. Camaraderie, a creative outlet, nothing too taxing to add to an already taxing life, the motivation to take just a tiny step forward, the thrill of success. Then you lead by baby steps, not by, parentheses, rather ridiculously complex, gargantuan leaps. It was a mistake I still regret, that silk sampler. While organizing the workroom this summer, I came across it. I think I've learned a bit, especially regarding stitchery, since then, but I still have a long, long way to go. The best lesson I learned? Keep it simple, uncomplicated, unhurried, relaxed. If your embroidery is harassing you, if it has become a cloud over your head or a weight upon your shoulders, step back. Slow down, relax, uncomplicate it. Otherwise, you just might go the way of my silk sampler, which was a complete fizzer. I thought that spoke, it's a story, but it spoke, I'm sure, to many people, where you just get beyond what really is fun. And pretty soon the hobby becomes a chore, and then it gets set aside, and then the days and weeks go by and you don't do it. And what was once a relaxation, a therapy, a release at night or on the weekends, is no more. And, you can see that class just dwindle. And people say, oh, I'm not going to that. You know, that's just a headache for me anymore. You know, I'd rather make flower cloth towels, you know. It was just fun. And I just got together. Yeah.
I'm glad you read it, you know, verbatim, because it was so beautifully written.
Yes.
It really was, you know, and I think timely as well, as we sit here talking about embarking on stump work.
So I know, exactly.
It is really perfect, because if nothing else, that chided us into, yes, use that 7-inch embroidery hoop, and you cannot make anything larger than that, the end.
Yep. Because it's real easy. You know, you see, like, this stump work book, you see those things, and, oh, man, some of that, I mean, stuff is just stunning. And you think, oh, I got to do that. I'd love to produce that. And then, you got to be careful, because you get in so far over your head that it just becomes just just drudgery. And then you set it aside. And then, you know, you set it aside, and then the other stitching that you were enjoying gets set aside with it. And pretty soon, that hobby's on a shelf somewhere collecting dust. And, and when I read that thing, I read it, and then I went to stitch, and I looked at the projects I have I've got several that I've not even started, and I'm not alone in that. And I thought, okay, I need to watch myself here, or I'll end up ruining this hobby and taking the fun out of it and the relaxation. And it really made me sit back and think, wait a minute, I need to be careful here. And, doesn't mean I'm not going to try stump work with you, but it's just.
No. And it's, I think what it is it's two things, right? It's what Mary said about know your audience and being able to read a room in that regard. But it's also knowing yourself. It's knowing for you, and it's different for every person, what is the right balance between, adding the element of complexity that will challenge you and keep you interested, and the element of, this is a place where my mind can rest.
Yes.
So where does that balance lie? And it changes from day to day sometimes, right? So that's why I think a lot of people have multiple projects going, because sometimes you need something that's going to push you and keep you interested and engaged. And other times you come home and you say, you know what, I just want to do 10 stitch for 5 hours and that's it, because that's about all I can manage, because you need to, you know, your mind needs to wander elsewhere, and that's the benefit you get. So sort of being able to read yourself the way you read a room is just as important. And perhaps having maybe a couple of different projects going at different times that allow you to appeal to whatever thing you need that day. You know, are you feeling bored and you need to amp it up a little bit, as Mary said, or do you need to rest your mind? It's almost like a painting that has areas of complexity, but then areas of white space. You need a place for your eyes to rest, and you need a place for your mind to rest. And a needlework piece can have both. Or sometimes you need two pieces to provide both of those things. So I think that's it's an important piece that she wrote. There's a lot of things about there that apply to needlework, but also apply to life in general, I think.
Yes. Oh, yeah. It isn't just a needlework thing. Yeah. No, that was just really good. That's one I'm keeping. I of course, so I could read it here, I copied it onto a piece of paper, and I'm just going to keep that down at the old stitching table. Just to remind me. Yeah. Let's not get out of control here and ruin a hobby. Let's keep it simple. So Yeah, so that was a good one. So thanks to Mary, and that's Mary Corbett with one T, in case you're wondering. Yeah, just one T. Thanks, Mary. So, okay, so speaking of names I've ruined, this comes from Jane Wood's Chili Hollow Needlepoint Adventure. That, you know, that's the full name that, yes, I now use each and every time. Jane Wood's Chili Hollow Needlepoint Adventure. We're very careful with that now. So, thanks, Jane. So, she had a thing. She had a thing that she linked to from Louise's Needlepoint June newsletter. And I think talking about a fiber that you are a big fan of, the Rainbow Gallery Neon Rays. As I recall, you rave about it, as I recall.
Something like that, except, yes, the exact opposite of that.
Okay. Yeah. That stuff.
Neon rays. So it's funny because Gary and I were talking about what we were going to address today. And he said, you know, I want to kind of talk about neon rays. And I said, God, I hate that stuff. And he said, good, then let's talk about that. I'm going to choose to look at it differently. It is a challenging material to work with. Because
positive spin queen. All right, fine.
I am a positive spin queen. You know, I'll own that. In our last podcast, I was the evangelist. Now I'm the positive spin queen. That's fine.
Okay.
No, it forces you to be honest, because with other threads that are not flat, that are not ribbon-like, you can let them twist a little bit and it's okay. And with threads that don't have a sheen, you can let them twist a little bit and it's okay. It's not going to be something that's going to be noticed by anyone that's not, you know, a master needleworker or a judge or somebody that is like you who looks at things like that. Neon rays allows no fault, right? You have to lay that thread perfectly, both as far as twist and tension, because if you don't, it won't look right. And what I find with it too is, even if you're stitching, like there's a piece that I'm working on now where you stitch it diagonally, and even then it looks uncomfortable to me because the width of the fiber is not the same as the width of the canvas. So there's gaps between. So you don't get that perfect satin sheen that's uniform across the way. So it's troublesome to stitch with. So, I don't like it because I look at it and it vexes me because it's not easy to work with. And it also tends to fray, and you have to use short thread lengths to make sure that you're not, you know, by the end of it, you're not looking at something that looks like, you know, a sheep and wool. But at the same time, it teaches you, and what it taught me the first time I worked with it was, you know, work with shorter threads. But it also, like I said, keeps you honest. You have to use a length tool, and you have to think about what you're doing on the front, but you also have to think about what you're doing on the back, because that's what's going to influence, you know, how it lays on the front. So if you want a thread that's going to force you to do good needlework, that is the one.
Yeah, it'll force you to do that.
Now that I've spoken its praises, go ahead and tell me how you hate it.
And I've used it, and I've used it successfully, but I avoid it.
It is, because it allows for no error. It really does.
And, you know, on the positive spin side, it really is a great effect. It really does. It's a neat fiber. It gives a great effect used properly, it's a struggle. So Louise, as reported by Jane Wood's Chili Hollow Needlepoint Adventure, Louise has these tips, four tips for neon rays. Rayon benefits from steaming or ironing. Use a wet paper towel. You've used it, right?
I was going to say the flat iron trick.
Yes, and that helps, huh? I did not do that.
Yep, because you don't have the bend in the fiber that comes from the card it came from. And I find that just the act of flat ironing it makes it a little bit more pliable and bendable. So it tends to lay a little bit easier.
Okay. Use a wet paper towel or sponge and draw the thread across it. Prepare a number of thread lengths ahead of time so they can dry before use. If time is an issue, you can try running the thread through a mini flat iron, which also removes the card kinks. Yeah, as you have done and as you suggested. This was interesting because this was one of the frustrations I had was you would thread the needle and you had to hang on to that sucker or it would pull out of the needle and always at a time when you didn't want it to. So
correct.
She suggests after threading the needle, pierce the ribbon near the eye to lock it into place and avoid slipping. And then,
that's a great idea.
Yeah, so that's an interesting one. I assume just ram a needle through it and it kind of forces the threads to connect. I got to try
well,
that.
Well, it makes sense. And I mean, in a sense, the wool, you know, analogy that I kind of threw around just to be funny before is apt because the way that neon rays frays, just by driving a needle through it will cause it to fray just a tiny bit, and probably enough that it will lock like that. That does make sense.
Yeah.
Because that's what wool does too. That's why you have to card wool because otherwise the threads are just completely locked together.
Okay. All right. Well, then that's worth trying. And then
yeah.
This one I already knew. Begin and end threads by using a Bargello tuck, and I would suggest not just a one loop Bargello tuck. I found myself doing a little extra weaving here and there to make sure that stuff stayed where it was supposed to. Beginning
okay.
and ending threads was a lot of work for me.
So tell me what a Bargello tuck is because I don't know. Because I don't have a lot of, I'm doing this on my own. I don't have a class, so I don't have somebody to show me these things. So I know what I did in the end to make the threads begin and end. And I'm curious to see whether or not I got anywhere close to what is recommended.
Okay, well, Bargello tuck is easier to show than describe. But wherever you're going to actually stitch, that's where you insert the neon ray or whatever thread into previously stitched threads.
Yes.
Then you come out, and then you loop over one or two threads, and then you go back to where you're actually going to stitch.
Oh, that's
yeah.
exactly what I'm doing.
Okay, yeah. I mean, it's a logical thing. But I found too often that even then it would slip out. So I would do some extra weaving or something to make sure that thing was locked down.
Mm-hmm. And well, you know what strikes me though? So that is kind of what I'm doing, but now that you're speaking of it, it almost makes me sort of harken back to the idea of how you get it to stay in the needle, which is to pierce the thread. So if you were to do that, right, so if you imagine if you're on the reverse side and you pull the first thread through and then you double back, if you then go through the thread that you just pulled through, so in other words, if you pierce the neon rays once and then you go underneath again in your second pass, that should pretty much lock it permanently where it can't slide now because now you've locked it to itself.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? That might
yeah,
be
does.
Worth trying.
And I think it's worth trying, yes.
Yeah. So yeah. Leave a little tiny bit of a tail so that when you go through for that second pass through, you penetrate the thread itself and then that will lock it pretty much permanently. And I'm trying to think, you could do that ending a thread as well.
Yes. Yes,
I like
exactly.
That.
Yes. So there's a tip. Then what anybody who's used this knows, use a laying tool to keep the stitches flat. Lay your stitches lay your stitches on both the front side and the back side of the canvas. This is I would put this in the slow stitch category for fiber. This extra
yeah.
step eliminates the little twist that appears when bringing the thread to the front of the canvas. And yeah, I fought with that many times. Be careful of knots and loops forming. Oh yeah. A knotted loop on the back of the stitch is guaranteed to work loose and appear on the front at some point. You definitely don't want this to happen after your completed piece is framed. Yeah, no kidding there. Watch your tension as well. And oh, this was the challenge for me. A too tight tension will stretch and thin out the stitch, while a too loose
yeah.
tension will expand and sag on the canvas. Yeah, you get too loose, and to me, it looks sloppy in a hurry. You really gotta.
Right.
That's why I say slow stitch fiber. Man, every stitch very slow.
Yeah, the width of the fiber itself is completely dependent on the tension. Other fibers don't really do that. They pretty much are what they are. You know, like even the Krynex, the flat ribbons, the width is the width, pretty much, I think. This, it really stretches. So if your tension isn't consistent, that's why I said, you know, it keeps you honest, because you really have to be on top of stitching absolutely perfectly to get it to be anywhere near, you know, good. And so now, of course, I'm going to go look at the piece that I stitched and look at all of it and find all the places where, you know, that's imperfect.
Right.
And that's fine. You know, like I said, this piece is my learning piece, so I expect there to be imperfections, and I'm okay with that. But yeah, you know, this is how you learn those little tricks.
Yep.
Isn't it?
Yep.
It's by kind of messing up these things. And the other, you know, the other one that helped me as well was when I was first stitching, actually, it was a different Krynex, but it was something that was very thick. And I had said that it was, and it was a ribbon. It was like an eighth inch wide ribbon. And one of the things that I had said was that as you come up through the beginning hole, the thread would, or the ribbon, I want to call it a thread and a ribbon at the same time, but the ribbon, the flatness of it would pucker to come through the hole. And you had said use a larger needle because that will dilate the hole enough that the thread will be able to pass through flat. And then it will naturally just collapse in on itself, and it will do so in a way that's not distorting the thread as much. So maybe that would be beneficial here as well. I don't know, because the neon raise is so flimsy and it just kind of bends with the wind anyway. So, I wonder if that wouldn't be.
Yeah. Helpful. I mean, I definitely would watch my needle size choice on that.
Yeah.
And then the last tip from Louise is, rayon, and well, I learned this early on. Oh, I had to pull out a whole section because I snagged it. Rayon is prone to snagging, so be sure to keep your canvas edges taped. Watch for any rough edges on your stretcher bars or frame. It is also a good idea to make sure your fingernails and hands are smooth. What a great excuse for a manicure. Well, yeah, not happening for me. But, yeah, the first time I used it, I had a good section stitched, and I snagged it. I forget what I snagged it on. I think it was the stretcher bar. There was a little, you know, piece of wood on the corner. I snagged that thing and just ruined it. And I had to pull all that out. So all that careful stitching had to all come out because it was ruined. And I had to start all over. And boy, that one time. And then after that, it was be so careful about where that thread is at all times. And, you know, I got through it, but, yeah, it's a challenging thread. But the thing is, it's a challenging thread, but it really done right and used properly gives a really great effect. So you can't,
it does.
You can't just throw it away and say, I'll never do it. But oh man, it'll make you earn your keep. That's for sure.
Yep. It forces you to stitch well.
Yep.
You don't have the opportunity to stitch, you know, adequately.
Right. So there's the tips from Louise. And I'll put a link to this, and I'll also put a link to Mary Corbett's with one T little story. So
we're gonna call her that every
forever
and ever now, right?
Yeah, it's Mary Corbett with one T and Jane Wood's Chili Hollow Needlepoint Adventure, all of the words. Yes.
Well done.
Yes. So there we go. So I'll put a link so that people can find those and copy them themselves. And then really excited this Sunday. Monica Pratt from Welcome Stitchery, the store that I frequent often, is our guest. So we had a great conversation with Monica about the store and how she got started and worked her way through. And 29 years they've been in business. So that's
yeah, that was a great conversation.
Yeah. Yep. So that'll be coming up Sunday. And that's it.
That is it. We will talk to everyone shortly.